Having an interview this morning with Bob Olson, who lives in Route 2, Morehead, Minnesota, and farms. His telephone number is 236-8871. Bob and I have been neighbors since he was born, I guess. I've known him. And this is for the benefit of the Heritage Society at Morehead State University. Bob, you've been told me that you'd been farming since you were pretty much some of your own equity, at least when farming was in when you were since you were 13 years old. What crops have you raised?
We've always raised wheat, barley, and sugar beets, and a couple times we've tried soybeans, but never stayed with it.
And so if you were 13 when you started on somewhat on your own, gaining your own equity, when would that be? How old are you now?
I'm 44 right now, and I started in 1953 is when I started farming.
Starting farming in 1915. Where were you going to school then?
I was going to school at the Morehead State Campus School.
At 13?
Mm-hmm.
Didn't you attend school at Clearview at all?
Yes, I went 8 years to Clearview, but when I went to senior high or just high school, then we came into Morehead.
And you finished high school
at Morehead State.
That's an interesting thing about our community is that a great number of the children went to Morehead State University High School. It was called Morehead State College then, high school.
Right.
Who are your teachers? Do you remember?
Well, we had Dr. Werner Brand was our principal.
Well, I was thinking more in the Clearview area.
Oh, okay. I had Art Volker and his wife Ina. She taught me in grade school in the second, third, and fourth grade, and I think Art himself taught me in fifth, sixth, seventh, and eighth. And I don't remember who my first grade teacher was right offhand.
Who were some of the folks that you were in school with?
Well, I went to school with Ronnie Krepps was in my grade, and Ralph McLaughlin, who lived on your farm and worked for you, he was also in my grade. And I think we were the only three guys in the graduating class in ours.
Nobody, no girls?
No. There was one for a part of the time that her dad worked over from Royal Allen. Her name was Dumert. And I think her Kathleen was in my grade, and her sister Marlene was in my younger sister's grade.
And how many brothers and sisters do you have, Bob? I've kind of forgotten myself.
I've got one sister that's older than I am, Judy, and I've got one sister that's younger, Artis. And then I have a younger brother, Dewey.
Let's just spend some time on your own family, that is, your own children.
Okay, I've got three children. Jared, whom we adopted in 1967. Jennifer, my daughter, was born in 1970. And Kevin, my son, is born in 1972.
Where are they now?
Jared is in senior high, planning on going into engineering. Jenny and Kevin are going to school in Morehead School District. Jenny in the start first year in a senior high, and Kevin is finishing up at Pope Seal this year.
What kind of range do you have now farming? I noticed that you and Dewey, and if you don't mind telling me, I'm not being curious, but it just you and Dewey and your dad seem to be always in the field together.
Well, my dad and I started together in a partnership in 1953. And we farmed together until 1968 under just a father-son partnership. And then we incorporated into a sub-S corporation with my dad and I, and we included my mother and my wife. And then over the years, I've passed a few shares along to my children as a way of getting some money for them to go to college. So they each have now 3% of my corporation. My brother Dewey, when he wanted to start farming in 1975, rented some land on his own. Basically, he rents the equipment for us, and we then reimburse him for the additional labor because he has less acreage than we do, so we pick up the difference in there. And so that's kind of the way we've operated now for a while.
And do you like that arrangement?
It's worked out pretty well for us. It gave Dewey a chance to come in without being just a hired help or being a junior member of the corporation. This way he has some decisions he can make, and it's up to him whether he makes it or not.
Does Dewey farm? Where does he farm?
Well, he's got two pieces of land, basically, that he rents. One is over in North Dakota, and then he rents another piece right south of one of those two parcels.
And he lives in town, doesn't he?
And he lives in town, as my dad does.
And what do you know? I mean, what? Give us a little bit of a description, or that is a conversation about what about farming conveniences changes since you started, and you never knew what it was not to have electricity or running water or anything like that on the farm, did you?
We've always had electricity as far back as I can remember, but we didn't always have running water. I can remember when my dad changed the well over and rigged it up so that we could have pressure in the house, and then we got into a bathtub and a stool and all those things. And I remember the inconvenience of getting up in the middle of the night and going outside and taking a bath in a tub, and all three of us, we were just talking about this the other night, all three of us kids had to have to sit down and share the same water in a old steel wash tub over by the furnace. And it was really, it was an old coal-fired furnace, one that just sat in the middle of the center of the house, and the heat radiated up. It didn't have any blower or anything. I remember getting out of bed in the morning, and you'd be cold, and you'd grab your clothes, and you'd run down and dress right on top of that furnace.
Well, that wasn't where you're living now.
That's an exact same house I live in
Do
now.
Do you remember when your folks lived up north?
Yes. Very little about it. I remember mostly the moving day in 1943 in the spring when we moved from that house my folks rented north of Cragness down to where we live now.
A little bit on your, it's kind of skipping around, but your personal life, your grandfather was farmed in our neighborhood.
Right, he farmed in Morton.
And his name was Oscar, wasn't it?
Right.
And your family has pretty well lived around Moorhead for a long time. That is your father's people. What about your mother's people? Where are they from?
Well, they homesteaded the piece that Dewey farms now over along the Wild Rice River. My great-grandparents came over from Norway and homesteaded on the piece across the river at first, and then after they found out after a couple of floods how bad that piece flooded, they moved to where the home site is now, and they have been there ever since. My grandmother and her husband stayed there, then my aunt and uncle stayed there, and currently my uncle is still residing on that farm, and Dewey is farming the land.
What is your mother's maiden name? I don't know.
Hexham was her maiden name.
And she was from over at Wild Rice, isn't that correct? That's
yeah,
where Dewey is now.
Basically, yeah.
On your, do you want to comment on your social life? What do you do for recreation, and what do you do for other than farming? And
well, pretty much right now, with my kids being in the teenagers, our kids take up a lot of our time, and our church takes up a lot of our time. My wife's very involved in the 4-H projects, and so we consequently don't take a lot of social functions in, except that they involve our kids. By the time we get through with that, we're too tired to be doing much on our own. We go out once in a while with some friends for supper and evening of dancing, and well, we belong to the Eagles Club, and we go over there occasionally for dancing and dining and stuff like that.
Who makes up your closer friends? Are they, and what is their business?
Probably Judy and Bob Vidian are our closest friends in farming right there in the neighborhood and the community. The rest of our friends are basically people from our church.
And what church is that, Bob?
Bethesda Lutheran Church, right on the south side of Moorhead now.
And what is your heritage? What do you consider your ethnic background, Bob?
Well, basically, my mother's side was all Norwegian, and on my dad's side, on his dad, that was basically Swedish. They came from Sweden. My grandfather was born here, but his mother came from Sweden, and his dad. And on my grandmother's, on my dad's mother's side, they were basically Norwegian people. They were the Haugans that lived out by Harwood, and I don't know how much further back I can go. I think Grandpa Haugen came from Norway and homesteaded in that area.
Just in case that nobody else puts it on the record, I think one of the most interesting people in our neighborhood that was related to you was Uncle Emil.
Yes.
And why don't you describe him or tell us something about him as you knew him and what he did and how long he was in our neighborhood?
Maybe I should identify him. He and his mother came over from Sweden, and then his mother's name at that time was Larson, and there was a lot of Larsons. So when he got here and as he grew up, he was being confused, so he changed his name to Lambert. And his mother married Charlie Olson, and that's where the Olson name came from. So my grandfather and what we called Uncle Emil were basically half-brothers. And he had the farm that we live on right now, and he never married, so he always had hired help, hired cooks, and things of that nature. And he was injured in an accident over at the Rootruff Siding, just a half a mile from our house. And what happened, they were moving some boxcars one day, and he got between them, and they crushed his hip. And in those days, what it basically did is put his hip out of joint. But they didn't know how to reset it, didn't know there was anything really wrong, and so they just let it go. Well, it eventually wore another socket alongside of the original one, so he always had one leg that was a little shorter. This consequently led to the fact that he did very little physical labor, did mostly managing and telling men what to do and hiring cooks and paying the bills. This is also probably why he at one time approached my dad then to come down and operate the farm with him, because he was unable to get out and drive the tractors and things like that for long hours. So that's when my dad decided to come down in 1943, and he and my dad formed a partnership and farmed together for a few years, and eventually my dad took over, so my uncle just traveled around the community and lived off of his investments and pretty much was a fixture around the community. Took a lot of pictures, got to see a lot of people. And
yeah, I see. Where are the pictures that he... I know, remember he was a great camera fan. And what did he do with them?
Well, some my Uncle Clarence, I believe, has, and some that my dad, Emo, has. And I don't know if they got divided up more than that in the family. Probably my Aunt Ethel out in Montana would have a few, because there were a number taken of her farm and her family. So...
Do you know what time that Emil came? Uncle Emil came to to the area?
No, I really don't.
But your dad, or your grandfather's people came from up in Harwood, didn't they? Or was that your grandmother's?
That would have been Charlie Olson. He came up in the Argusville area. That's where he originally lived. And his grandfather, or his father before him, were up in that area.
Bob, do you have any... incidents of celebration of holidays or Christmas or Thanksgiving or Easter or 4th of July or any other, maybe even some Swedish holidays. Do you remember any of them specifically or any incident with them?
I don't know that I remember any particular incidents. We always, when I was a kid, had the problem, of course, with both sets of in-laws on my parents' side living here. So if we celebrated Thanksgiving with my dad's side of the family, we would celebrate Christmas with my mom's side, and then the next year we would reverse. And that's kind of one of the things that we did. Easter was not a big celebration at our house. That was usually just a family day, church day. 4th of July is probably the big holiday in our personal family, because my mom's birthday happens to fall on the 4th of July. And since we've had a lake home, why, all of the kids and usually my mom's family, her sisters and their families would come down to the lake, and for a number of years now they've always gotten together and celebrate the 4th of July with the fireworks. And
well, your family were all, as I recall, were all active fishermen.
Yes.
And do you know of any instance at the lake? You always had a cottage, I know. You were the envy of ours, because we didn't have a cottage, and we used to go to your grandparents once in a while.
Yeah, my grandpa, and I don't know exactly what time he acquired this old cottage that he had, but I know that's an area where they used to go fishing even before. And my dad used to tell me of the times that they would go down there. They'd leave very early in the morning, go down and catch a mess of fish, and come back. And some of the long days they would have to put in, and now we think nothing of driving down there and spending an evening and coming back in the morning, or you know, going down for the day, and how hard it is now or then to get down and come back. But they also caught a lot more fish than we do in these days too. Fish were a lot more plentiful. He said it was nothing to go down and catch a whole gunny sack full of sunfish, three or four people. And it just seems like when it would rain, there were times that we would takeoff a day, and maybe two or three men, and my dad and I would go down and we'd go fishing, and we'd get in the boat about 8:30, 9 o'clock in the morning and fish until dark and then turn around and come back home. And I remember that I would get so tired of sitting in that boat, especially if I'd had good luck. My dad said if I caught my limit, I'd fold up my pole and hook my line up and lay it down and say, well, I got my fish, now it's up to you guys to catch the rest of them.
Well, I know your grandfather's a great fisherman, and I used to go and visit him just a mile and a half from our place, and he always would end up, I never fished, and he used to give me packets of fish out of the freezer because your grandmother said, it's getting too full, you better give Douglas some fresh fish, and he and I often got fresh fish from your grandfather. Your grandfather, describe your grandfather. I think he really was one of the people in our neighborhood who said very little, but he seemed to be known by everybody. Would you like to describe your grandfather?
He was a tall man and very heavy, but I am told, before I can remember him, he was a very strong man. They said he could lift almost anything. And of course, in those days, they raised potatoes and they scooped sugar beets, and they had animals they had to hand feed and clean up the manure and stuff like that. So I suppose this is what it led to. But in when I was in grade school one day, they came and they called my Aunt Dorothy away from school, and she left in tears, and us kids never knew what happened until we got home from school and we found out he'd been hurt in a harvest accident in beet harvest. And it was then they found out he had diabetes, and of course from then he had to restrict his farming activities. But he never farmed a lot of land. He went through the Depression. He had some building site that he had that wasn't very good that they'd moved on to and rented, and then eventually he moved up to the place where he and his wife spent most of their farming life. And when the Depression came along, he had a real tough time paying for it. And as a matter of fact, one fall he went into the bank and he said, well, he didn't know what he was going to do. He couldn't make the payment on the principal. He could pay some on the interest. And the banker said, if I were you, I'd give him back the farm. He said, I wouldn't even bother to take it. He said, I'll sell you one for less money than what you owe on that right across the road, just about. And so my grandfather went to his landlord and told him that. And he said, well, maybe we should sit down and talk about it. So the banker and the guy he owed the money to and my grandfather sat down in the bank the next day and discussed it. And the guy took half the principal off, didn't have to make any payments that year, and he got him started going again, and he was able to keep the farm. Otherwise, he would have lost it. And I think that tended to leave to the conservatism of our family. My dad saw my grandfather in that position and how tough it was. And he spread that along to me, and I think that carried out throughout my grandfather's life. He was conservative in his investments from that point on.
Well, who owned that land? That's Section 30. It must be Section 30. No, it's Section 26, isn't it?
26, I would guess.
Section 26 in Moorhead Township. What? Who owned that land, do you know? Before your grandfather bought it?
No, I really don't know the name.
Well, now, you've had, you and your dad have had a reputation in the community of having one of the, doing the best job of farming in our neighborhood. At least that's the general attitude of the neighbors. And how do you, why do you think you do? Why do you think you have been as proficient, of course?
Well, I don't know why we do. I guess it's just something that's developed between my dad and I over a period of years. He started me out with a hole in a beet field and pressed upon me the fact that he wanted those beets clean. And at a time when we didn't have herbicides to clean up these fields, we only had mechanical means, and we saw how hard that was. And I guess we figured that if you eliminated the seed in the fall of the year and it didn't have a lot out there, eventually that hoeing job was going to get a lot easier. So I suppose that's where it came from.
Now, you never used many, as I recall, never used many migrants.
No.
At least in recent years. Your grandfather used them, and most of us used the migrants, but you didn't. And how did you handle that?
Well, back in the early 50s, when the guy invented a cotton chopper, one of our neighbors went down and looked at it, and he said, would that be a thing that they could use to thin our beets with? And he brought one on up here and showed it to my dad. My dad says, well, bring me up one, too. And so
Who was that, Bob?
That was Morky Keister and Mel Keister that went down and met the guy. And so they brought it up, and we started with a mechanical thinner, and we decided that was a whole lot easier than getting out there and hand-hoeing them. You didn't have as much of a problem with all the labor. You didn't have to provide housing and all those kinds of things. So we started out with a mechanical thinner that year, and we found out we could get a lot of the work done, and my two sisters and I started doing the balance of the thinning and the weeding, and it progressed so that as my dad needed more help with the cultivating and operating of the thinning and the rotary hoeing and the mechanical means, we found we could get by without a lot of labor. So for many years, my two sisters did all the beet hoeing, and Dad and I did the rest of the work on the farm in the summertime.
Well, Dewey was there too, of course.
As Dewey got older, one year when Artis got married, she and her husband hoed all the beets, and after they grew up and got married and moved away, then my dad tried using some of the local help. He'd pick up down on the front street. Basically, they were winos and day laborers that, you know, they wouldn't hold a job for very long, and they didn't want a job for very long. And we used those for, I suppose, 7-8 years. And then one year, a church group approached us. They wanted to bring some youth out. And our first experience with them was really sad. We didn't get them out there and work with them enough. We gave them a price per row and let them work by themselves on their own. And we found out that that just didn't work. So our next experience, I tried a couple of boys that I knew that I thought would be good workers, but I worked with them. And as long as I was with them, and I didn't exceed 10 in number, I found I could do a pretty good job with youth, get a better job than I could with migrants, and the only thing I had to do was spend about 10 days with them. So consequently, that became our program until we got into more and more use of herbicides. Now with the herbicides, we're able to get it down to where we can spend maybe 5-6 days out there, and probably only 2 or 3 besides myself to do the work.
A little surprise, Bob. You forgot one of the important people that helped in the in those weeding that I recall, and that is your mother. She spent some time in the fields too.
Yes, but not a lot. But she did come out there.
And you'd be a mistake not to say that she helped too.
She came out a couple of years ago just for the exercise of walking up and down the fields. She's just walking up and down the street anyway, and she said that hoeing has got so easy that she really didn't mind doing it, and she hoed about 25 acres.
Do you remember any specific fall or spring that was real upsetting to you in the matter of farming?
The one I remember the most predominant is the fall of 1957. That was the year after I had graduated from high school, and I was getting ready to go to college in the fall, and my dad started having a lot of back trouble. We had 2-row John Deere harvesters. They had a picnic table on them, and so we had a man that had worked for us, Art Larson, and his wife Rosie. They lived down by Sabin with a few acres that they farmed, and they would come up and help my dad in the fall. And that harvester had a topper that sat underneath the belly of the tractor, and then you pulled the lifting unit behind, and it would bring the beets up on this table, and then they had to pick the dirt off, and once in a while there would be a beet with too much green, and they had a knife that they would pick up and top those beets with. And when it got to be wet and rainy, my dad had problems sitting on the tractor, and just his back was too much for him, so then I had to take over. And I finished out the harvest with him, or for him, and in January of that year, of course, he had to go in and have a back operation. And I remember that we were harvesting still way out into November, and I remember that we were hauling him into the Moorhead factory, and there was one piler right down from the scale. And they didn't start that thing so very far down from that scale, but it never got to the scale because they were processing them out of that pile almost as fast as we were hauling them in because we were having so much trouble with mud and tops. We had to pull trucks, and oh, it was just a real tough harvest.
What's your relationship or attitude as far as the credit agents are concerned? Who do you use, and how do you, if you don't mind telling us, and what your attitude about to the credit agencies are?
Well, we've been lucky. We've been very conservative. When I started out, my dad let me sign a note to him and I borrowed the operating capital from him, and I've paid my dad back in about 4 years and got on my feet, got my own operating capital. And I've only borrowed money once since in my life, and that's when we acquired American Crystal. I signed a note, and in 2 years I had that paid off. Otherwise, my sole credit has been when I bought land, I bought it on contract for deed.
Do you, so you aren't, you've never used ASC or S, I mean, the Federal Land Bank or the Production Credit or the Farm and Home or any federal credits at all?
Never used a one.
And what about farm organizations? Do you ever belong? Or what do you think of them?
We've never belonged to any of the Farm Bureau or Farmers Union or NFO, and primarily because they always seem fragmented. When you had one saying you wanted to go one way, you had another one saying you wanted to go another, and we decided that we'd wait till they all got together and joined one, and we have speak with one voice.
What about cooperatives? Have you any have you any attitude about cooperatives?
Been involved in two cooperatives. Our local grain elevator is a cooperative, and then of course American Crystal, the beet cooperative. And we've gotten along fairly well in cooperatives. My dad was on the board of directors of Cragness for a number of years, and we've participated in some of the boards with the Red River Valley Sugar Beet Growers Association, which has also been related to the cooperative of American Crystal.
Well, you have something to do with the Growers Association, don't you?
I sit on the research committee, and I've been on there since 1971. Now it's the Research and Education Board that we have a joint venture with the MNDAC co-op at Wahpeton and Southern Minnesota Beet Cooperative at Renville, and then the all five American Crystal factories. And it's basically grower money that's checked off from the beet check that we dispense to the University of Minnesota, St. Paul campus and Crookston, and NDSU. And we have projects that we support and generally get grant money or attract grant money. And we have production type research that applies strictly to growers.
Who else on the board with you, Bob? I mean, right locally.
Paul Horn is the other member of the board from the Moorhead Factory District.
What do you use insecticides and herbicides? And what's been the transition as far as machinery is concerned in your farming operation?
Well, going back to insecticides, we didn't use a lot of insecticides until the sugar beet root maggot became a problem, and then we used insecticides strictly on our beet planters. Herbicides have been something that we didn't use back in the early 50s and late and 60s when we started. Now it's gotten to the point where we use herbicides quite a bit. We usually apply pre-emerge herbicides to most of our beet acreage, and on some of the grain acreage we apply some wild oat pre-emergence, and all have some post-emergence, whether it be spot or broadcast.
Bob, we've talked about your family, about your affiliation with the growing sugar beets and the changes that have occurred in the matter of farming methods as you've seen them. They haven't been as major a change as it has been in your dad and my time, but they've been changes. And we've also talked about your ethnic background being Swedish, and you've always talked English in your home. You have never talked Swedish. And we've also talked about some of your days of celebration or recreation, and you said the 4th of July was the day that you, because it was your mother's birthday, and the farm work you've done. And you have never been a member of a farm organization, but you have you have been active in the cooperative and in the Growers Association of Sugar Beets. Do you belong to any of the commodity groups?
No.
Wheat or barley association?
We belong to the Wheat Growers Association, but have not been active other than just a dues-paying member of it.
And what about your political activity?
We've been involved too much in the political parties, but my dad served on the school board and the township board, and when he left and moved to town in 1972, I took over one of the positions of the town board as clerk, and then I moved up to supervisor, which I currently hold. I'm also in the board of directors of the Clay County unit of the Township Officers Association, currently serving as chairman of that group. And so I now have about 12 years of township experience behind me. I have served 3 years on the Clay County Planning Commission, and that's been about the extent of our...
Do you have any... What about... What is your attitude about politics?
Well, politics are a necessary evil, I guess is the way you could sum it up.
Mm-hmm.
There is a certain amount of things that we need to do and to be involved in our communities, and it takes time away sometimes from our jobs, and sometimes it involves conflict with our neighbors when we get into disputes, but these are things that we have to do, and we learn from our mistakes and move forward by planning something better for our township and our community.
What do you do for additional education, or what you might call reading, or as it relates to your reading or your magazines or your books, or what do you use, or what do you do? Do you get a daily paper?
Yeah, we get a daily paper, and I subscribe to several farm magazines. I subscribe to a couple of newsletters, some that are specific, like, for example, marketing newsletters. And being on the Research and Education Board has been real helpful to me in keeping up with current things and learning about new things as they are developed. So in the sugar beet industry, I feel I really have had an advantage by being on that research board. Otherwise, you depend a lot upon meetings in the wintertime where you go to meetings and learn about new products, learn how to use new equipment, how to apply things, go to dealers and try new pieces of equipment. Occasionally, we've even had a few pieces brought to our farm that were brand new, and we've been working with the original inventor to try and improve it or relate it to the area so that we can use it. So we've learned by experience, sometimes hard knocks.
What are some of the magazines you read, do you?
Read Successful Farming, Farm Journal, Buying for the Farm, the Minnesota Farmer, are just some of the ones that come to mind. Local ones is the Back 40 and the Fargo Forum. And that takes about the rest of them.
Well, Bob, I don't know. We've reviewed pretty much what you said, and I don't know. Okay, Bob, I think what you ought to do is list some of the changes that have occurred in that you recall.
Well, we talked about machinery a little bit ago, and I can remember when I started farming, my dad had track-type tractors, Caterpillars, and that's what I remember starting with. And I think that's really been a change when we went to big rubber-tired four-wheel drive tractors. We used to load the tractor down and pull it heavy and travel at slow speeds. Now we load the tractors a little lighter for their horsepower and we travel faster. And the problem in both situations was compaction. The Cat, we went to that to try to keep from leaving wheel tracks, particularly in the spring of the year. And we're still fighting that, only now we're loading the tractors lighter and putting them on more tires to get the same job done. Equipment has gotten considerably larger, which has made transporting from field to field by folding hydraulics. That was a great thing for us, because before that, I can remember people with mechanical lifts having multiple hitches and multiple units and having to take them apart and trail 3-4 units behind one another down the road, and then they would have a Cat in front, so they'd have to load that on a trailer and travel many miles between the fields. And it really was quite time-consuming to do that. Now we come out with a four-wheel drive, hit a couple levers, and the thing folds up hydraulically in a couple minutes, and down the road you go. Some of the changes I remember back when I was a kid occurs also in combines. I remember when my dad got the first John Deere combine that he had was a Model 12A, 6-foot combine, and I had to go out and help drive truck. It had about a 25 bushel grain tank on it. It combined till the tank got full, and I'd have to follow behind with the truck and pull up behind it, and they'd stop and take the auger and unhook it, lay it on the side of the truck. Then they'd have to put the auger in gear and
idle the grain out, and then I'd have to get up in the truck and shovel it away because the auger was so short you couldn't hardly reach over the side of the truck. And then when that was all done, you have to stop and hook the auger back up on the combine and switch gears and start the combine up and take off and go again. And I remember spending many, many hours on that old combine. When I started farming with my dad, then we got a Model 65 John Deere combine that had an auger that stuck out over the top of the truck. We could unload on the goal. And gee, we really thought we had something and we could keep right on going. But it was still a pull-type combine, had a separate engine to drive the combine, and we would have to travel very, very slow as we could with the tractor. We'd have it in the bottom gear and sometimes just idling engines, and once in a while we'd even have to push the clutch in just to let the combine catch up in the swamp. And then along in about the early 60s, I guess, we went to power takeoff combines, and I remember the transition of putting a tractor in gear, running the throttle, full throttle, and letting that big combine chew up that swath no matter what happened. The only way you could stop was to push in the clutch, and it was really hard to keep from pulling that throttle back as you got up there. It was a tough transition. But now those combines are getting smaller. So there's been quite a change in just my lifetime in those two pieces of equipment. Some of the other things I remember, when I was a kid, we had a dirt road going by our place that was about the same level as the fields along it, very little drainage. And I can remember when Adolf Erickson came in with his two cats and scrapers and his cat and bulldozer, and he started in the land one day, and he pushed up and started to make up a road, and eventually the scrapers got in there and scraped out some of the dirt and leveled it out, and then he finished with a blade and he made the road going past our place. And I can remember many of the roads that were like the ones by our place. And these roads were built and the new culverts were installed, and it was for better drainage, better farm to market roads, transportation for the mail route and school bus, and been quite a change there too over the years that I can recall. Our township was fortunate with people like my dad that were on the board. They went ahead and they built up a lot of the township roads, and they turned them over to the county, and the county then took over the maintenance on them. So we today have a bigger percentage of county roads in our township, less township roads for our people to take care of, because they had the foresight to levy the mills, to go out and get the money and build those roads up. They could see that they were going to be coming out ahead down the road someday.
You're on the township board. Who serves with you, Bob?
Ward Cater is the chairman of the board. Bob Vidine is the other supervisor. Leland Vetti is our clerk. And then Hal Sellers is our zoning administrator. And Larry Peterson is our treasurer.
One thing we have talked about, Bob, principally about nothing of negative side of life. And do you have any low points that you can recall in your life when and what caused them, not psychologically, but just where you had some real questions about the future and that sort of thing?
Well, I suppose when I was in high school would be, I don't know if you really call it a low point, but it was a time when I questioned, you know, what should I do? Should I stay and farm? Is that the best life? Or should I go out into something? And I had two loves, flying and farming at that time. And I guess farming won out, and economics forced me out of the flying. So I think that was a time when I also had a lot of problem with acne. And I remember one summer it was really, really wet, and we had a lot of sweet clover to fall. And it was in June. And I can remember then thinking, oh, God, if we can ever get this stuff plowed down, I'd be so grateful. Mosquitoes, oh, they were thick. The clover was so tall you couldn't even see the cat smokestack on the other side of the field. And old Art Larson and I plowed a 50-acre field, and I think it took us about a week and a half. I would start real early in the morning, and he'd come about 7:30, 8 o'clock and relieve me, and then he would plow, and I'd go home and get some rest, and then I'd come back about 10 o'clock and plow till noon, and then Art would take the tractor and disc up the ground that we had plowed, what little there was, and follow us up to keep it from baking so hard. And then we take turns trading off over noon hour, and in the afternoon for a while Art would disc and I'd plow, and then he'd go home, and then I'd continue to plow on into the night. And I remember lots of times you didn't go 50 feet and you'd stand and pull things, tall sweet clover out of the plow, and the mosquitoes would eat you up. And Oh, that had to be something that stuck out as a low point, I guess.
I remember it well. Bob, why don't you comment just a few minutes on drainage and its effect on our community and how we've handled it and what we could do?
Well, basically, being that we're so flat in our area, basically most of the ground in my that I farm, it falls about a foot per mile. And so when we've built roads, I suppose you might say we've built some drainage, but part of the problem was we built roads before that didn't have drainage, and we built dikes. And so then we needed to change that drainage. Over the years, as the city of Morehead has grown out, the natural coulees and the natural outlets have been clogged up by the city building into them. So we've had to divert water from the northwesterly flow, which is a natural flow, and divert it to straight westerly flows, which means we've had to cut through some serious ridges. And when you do that, then you have this drainage going through there, you have a certain amount of normal erosion. We have a constant problem of maintaining those ditches by cleaning them out, keeping that natural silting process out of there. What we will be doing in the future is really hard to say with the new laws and things that are coming into effect, consumers being what they are. One of the problems we've had in our township, some of the houses that were built in the River Oaks area were built down in an area that was entirely too low. And we didn't have
floodplain, isn't that what they call it?
Basically in the floodplain. We didn't have laws on the books that would prevent people from living in those areas. And it was a nice area, and people thought, gee, that would really be great. Well, then in the spring of the year, when it came along and flooded them out, then they came back and said, hey, you shouldn't have never let us build here. So what's been done was a project to move six of the houses that were the lowest down in that area. They were basically bought up by the federal government and moved out and resold, and the people were paid for them, and so they were gotten back out of there. The ones that are left that are down into the area that is closest to the floodplain now that have walkout basements will be, eventually, their walkout basements will have to be boarded up. There will have to be some kind of earthen dike built over them so that they won't be flooded in the spring. And so that will take care of that flooding in that particular area.
Bob, you've been on the township board, and in just recent years, the relationship between the township and the city has had some high points and low points. And why don't you tell just a story, well, they're both on the drainage and on the power line. Tell us that story, if you can. I think that should be recorded.
You mean the power line that came in
yes.
along the railroad track?
Yes.
Well, there was a couple of articles in the paper, and I noticed them, and about the city needed to bring in more power to the city of Morehead. It was going to come from, I think it was Otter Tail Power Company.
Well, it was really from the dam out west,
yeah.
Indirectly.
And they were going to bring the power in from the west and go right alongside of one of Otter Tail Power's lines and come up to the railroad track in Section 34 and then turn north and follow the railroad into the city of Morehead. And they went ahead, built all their design, decided what they were going to have. They ordered the materials, bid it out, and had it delivered. And then they decided to come out and talk to the farmers about getting easements. Well, prior to this, I had gone in and talked to the people in the public service and told them that, you know, maybe you should talk to the farmers out. Maybe putting that power line right on alongside of that other one is not the best thing to do. Also, they were going to follow the railroad track, but they wanted to be 50 feet away from the railroads right away. Well, for farming purposes, that just meant you were going to have to swing out 50 feet with your large equipment. And if you had something that was over 50 feet wide, you couldn't get around that pole. So we also didn't know exactly where the railroad right-of-way quit. So we didn't know how wide this little strip was going to be. And trying to get information was impossible. So after they got their equipment all ordered and they decided to come out and talk to us, they waited till we were in the field in the spring of the year, just as soon as we got seeding. They came out and they handed us a contract and said, here, we want you to sign this easement. We're going to build a power line. And we said, well, wait a minute, what are we going to get paid for this? And where's the pole going to go? And all kinds of questions. Well, eventually, that developed into a meeting. And that included the people who farmed on the North Dakota side that they were coming to the east across, and Minnesota people who were going east and then north. What happened was the people in North Dakota said, you can't come over and condemn our land. You're a Minnesota business. You can't do that in North Dakota. And they said, we've got special privilege from North Dakota legislature to come over and condemn your land. So if you don't give us easements, we're going to build a power line anyway. That proved not to be true. They also told that to us, that they were going to condemn our property, so you might as well sign the easement. Well, then they kind of backed off after this meeting in late May or early June, and they didn't say anything. And as soon as we started combining and we were all real busy, they came out and hit us again, one at a time. And they went to the very first guy and said, you're the very last man to sign. Now you better hit and get your easement signed or we're going to start condemnation and that's going to tie you up in court and, oh, we're going to do all kinds of things to you. So the guys went ahead and accepted the price and signed the easements. In some cases they got small concessions on things, but not very much, as to maybe where they were going to locate a cable for a tie or something like that. That never happened. The thing was never built. And it went along about 2 years and we wondered what in the heck happened. All of a sudden, there's a notice in the paper in December, and it says that the Minnesota Environmental Quality Control Board is locating a power substation right along the railroad track in Kurtz Township for use by the city of Moorhead. Anybody having any comments on this was advised to call the number. So I called the gentleman and started checking into it to see what was all about. The city had now changed. They were going to tie into a different line. They were going to hook in straight south of Moorhead. The line would be all in Minnesota, so they would have power of condemnation, and they were going to go ahead and build a line. Well, this concerned me because we already had signed the easements. We had never been paid, and there were things in that easement that some of us still didn't like, and we found out that they didn't have power of condemnation in North Dakota, which they claimed. We found out that this price they had offered us was not a fair price, and that they really weren't going to release all of the easements that they did have on the east-west line. They were going to keep those. So we went to the Environmental Quality Control Board, and exactly what all happened, I don't know because I wasn't present. But after us, all the landowners on the Minnesota side that were involved got together. We had a meeting. We met with Vance Thysel. We went up and met with Mr. McCauley and explained what we wanted to do. He still didn't want to talk to us. So we went to the Environmental Quality Control Board, sent them a letter telling them exactly what had happened in the past, and they had a hearing. We could not be involved in the hearing because we were on the siting of the poles. The hearing was on the siting of the power substation. So they've said in the law that that had nothing to do with it. We argued through our letter that it did have a direct effect as to where you site that station. It's a direct line to the city of Moorhead where they're going to make the next connection. Therefore, we were directly involved in the siting of that substation. What must have evolved down there is that they went home down and told Mr. McCauley, you go home and get things ironed out with your neighbors. They were not happy, apparently, with what he did, because when he came back, he was a very much different person to talk to. He came to the township board, went ahead and agreed to a conditional use permit, agreed to remove the easements he did not need, agreed to a new price, and agreed to talk to the railroad about putting it on railroad property so we could keep it in a straight line instead of going out in Dwayne Carlstrom's land in Section 34. And he also agreed to let us renegotiate the price. We set the price, what we felt was reasonable, went in to talk to him about it. There was absolutely no argument. If that's what you gentlemen want, that's what you shall have. And he did everything just exactly the way we wanted.
It's kind of an interesting story in our neighborhood, I know, and I didn't know the details of it, and I knew there was some problem. What is the problem with the township as regards to the moving out of the city? What is your attitude about the city taking in properties in Moorhead Township?
Well, in recent years, it's gotten considerably better. We've had a better working relationship with the planning commissioner, the city planner, and the council. And we have created some problems for the city, but the city has created some problems for us. One I alluded to earlier was they build out into the areas where we have natural drains. They want to cover those drains and build buildings on them and divert the water. And this is always a much more difficult thing to do, is flow water through a ridge and flow it west rather than northwest. The city has come out and annexed some property south of County Road 76, which at the time they annexed it, we told them they didn't need it. And they didn't need it. They had gone out and built the area up north of County Road 76, they.
Where does 76 go? Who did it go by? Which road is that?
Well, basically, it runs west of State Highway 75, and it would go down to the old Byron Ogren property.
Okay.
And it also curves around the River Oaks and comes back up by the Sunnyside School, or the Sunnyside Furniture Mart, as it's known now. And they annexed about, I think it's 100 acres of property in there now. But they really didn't need it. They had built this area up to the north side, Riverview Estates. They had a lot of empty lots in there. They had a lot of people who had bought lots down there and built homes and who had homes for sale up in Moorhead where they had lived previously. And they hadn't sold those homes. They had a number of lots in the Village Green area, Riverview Estates area. They didn't need, a country club area was being built about this same time. So they really didn't need it. And we were quite upset about it because the city had come out one time and said that they wanted to change the coulee that ran through County Road 76 and ran up into the city, and they wanted to run that straight west. What they wanted to do is make a big open ditch, swale, and then they wanted to put about a 5-foot tube in the bottom of this thing. That would help to keep it dry so that there wouldn't be cattails and things and it would be kept mowed. Well, that was a pretty good solution, except for one thing. They wanted to start building on the property they'd annexed over by River Oaks, south of 76. That they wanted to build up and put their surface drainage off of that city property into that same drain. When you do that and the farmland is higher, you're naturally someplace going to put a trap in so that you can shut that agricultural drainage off. That would have occurred at the intersection of County Road 76 and State Highway 75, because that being the high point there that they wanted to cross. So as soon as the water from the ag land would come down and become a problem in the city, they would shut it off and flood us out. They did this very same thing prior to the building and adding on a Village Green. Water coming from the south along Highway 52 would come into that area and flow in and flood, get to be into the houses, get across 94, getting up into the Holiday Mall area, a pump would fail or something, they go back to 94 and dike it. This then would cause the property owner on the south side of 94 to take all the water from the south, couldn't get rid of it to the north or the west through the city, he went under. In the spring, this isn't as serious. It delays his seeding of crops and reduces his yield. But when this happens in the middle of the summer, like it did in the flood of 69, he just totally got wiped out. Nowhere to go, no recourse. The city didn't pay him.
Who was that?
Leland Betty and Albert.
Oh, that's
Betty.
Right. Mm-hmm.
They lost a lot of beans that year. They tried to sue the city. They couldn't do it. The city went and got an expert, was supposed to be a neutral expert. He was a former city engineer. That was the guy who came down and made the ruling as to whether Leland got hurt or not. Obviously, he took the city's point of view. You had to prove whose water it was that hurt the bean. Was it the one that fell from the sky? The one that came from the south, from the ag drainage, or the one that was held from going out by the city? Well, there's no way you could divide water into those three categories when it's 6 inches deep on your bean fields, you know. So that wiped Albert out almost that year. So he just decided that he wasn't going to face this year after year, and he was smart. He turned it over to some developers, and they built the Village Green Addition and golf course.
Bob, what do you think this sort of thing, the drainage and the power plant, has done as far as the attitude to the city is concerned?
Well, it's made us get a lot smarter. We've learned to get our things together, and we've learned to plan ahead and not just plain sit and wait till things happen. We've tried to develop a township zoning ordinance so that we control our development, and it's made us watch what goes on. It's made us realize that we're in this thing together, and I think we've gotten the city to realize that they've made some mistakes in the past. And now they come out when they start a project and they talk to us in the beginning. So I think that it's, the effect has been to help. It's taken a while, but we're getting there.
Do you think it's affected the attitude of the general neighborhood to the business in Moorhead in any way?
No, I don't think it's hurt so much in the businesses. I think it's mostly been between the city government and the township.
Mm-hmm. Well, Bob, thank you very much.
Sure.